Well, let's get back to Post-Classical with Joe Horowitz and Angel Giordano's. I'm Bill McLaughlin, your host, and we're celebrating Joe's new book called Dvorak's Prophecy, number 11 in your canon. Holy smokes, Joe, how'd you ever write that many books?
I can't help it.
Okay. You know what? You care so passionately about it. I've known you for a long time. You can get to almost like levels of fistfight excitement about something. But what I love about the quality of this new book is that there's a kind of a temperance to it. Have you mellowed with age? Because I find the voice that you use there wonderful. Don't you feel the same thing on how?
I love that. That was great.
Well, I know. Yeah, Joe does care. We all care. We're musicians. We care a lot.
I cannot agree more that this is a very, very personal book of reflections. Absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, I wish you the best luck with it. I've read all of your books going back. You know what my favorite was, I first got onto, was your book about Toscanini, which was more about the radio business. Because, Joe, you don't go out to kill just one dragon at a time. He doesn't. He sets out like a knight errant and like, what do I got to kill now? Let's get Toscanini. No, let's talk about NBC Symphony. Let's talk about... Oh, the commercialization of radio and all this. You always get two or three topics, and I learned so much from your books. Bravo, man. You are a marvel. I admire you very much.
Well, I'm very grateful to both of you and also to Dave Ozenberg for this opportunity to talk about my new book. And I appreciate your enthusiasm.
Oh, man, it's great. I've learned so much stuff, and even the stuff I don't like very much, I always learn from, sometimes even more.
So we've been talking about these composers who feast on the vernacular, who have been marginalized and sidelined in the way we've told ourselves the story of American classical music. And we started with Harry Burley, and then we talked about Dvorak and Ives and Gershwin and William Levy Dawson. And now we come to another huge figure who still remains seemingly insignificant, a name that's not known or barely known, Silvestre Revueltas, another master appropriator of the vernacular, in this case the Mexican vernacular. I must have come to this composer through you, Angel. It must have been what? Well, the first time we did an all Revueltas program was at the Library of Congress, wasn't it?
Well, actually, that was, Joe, the first concert we presented as a post-classical.
Right. There was even before that, yeah.
We presented Redes, that was May 1st, 2003. That was the official presentation of post-classical ensemble. We created a program on Revueltas, including the soundtrack together with the film of Redes.
And then, Bill, you were there at the Library of Congress when we did an all Revueltas program.
I remember it very, very well. That was considerably later, after we had started doing this show together. But I remember that wonderful woman you sing, Caminando, Caminando, over and over. What was her name? She was a great singer.
Absolutely, Eugenia León.
Yeah, that was a great concert. And the people at the Library of Congress loved that concert. So do all of us in the audience. Tell us about Revueltas. He's born around the turn of the century, right on top of Gershwin and...
Amazing.
Ellington and Copland and a lot of those
Everybody
guys.
Everybody we're dealing with is born
around 1900.
Around 1900.
Yeah. And his life was short. He died around 1940 or 41?
1940. He was born in 1899. He died in 1940, disillusioned, alcoholic.
Violin player, I think. A really good musician.
A virtuoso violinist. And I would guess to a considerable degree a self-taught composer because his training was as an instrumentalist. And I think that's very pertinent. We're talking about people who are self-invented, self-made, highly original, without being modernists.
You know what I'm thinking about? Dvorak himself was born considerably early, 1842. He's kind of an organ scholar, which is like a very low-grade way. He didn't go to the Prague Conservatory, went to the Prague Organ School. He comes out as maybe a church organist and finds a job playing viola with the Prague Opera. He sort of taught himself music from the inside out, like Revueltas.
I really don't know if they're comparable or not. I'm sure that Dvorak had more schooling as a composer.
No doubt.
Because Revueltas wasn't even, as far as we can tell, intending to become a composer.
Mm.
And his compositions fall pretty much within a single decade.
He wrote for film, which was just burgeoning in Mexico at the time, the 1930s.
He has something like 10 film scores. The film that Angel mentioned, Redes, meaning nets, is an iconic Mexican film that we, meaning Post-Classical Ensemble, have presented via Naxos DVD as a film with a newly recorded soundtrack.
Mm.
This is certainly one of the greatest soundtracks ever composed for a film. What would you like to tell us about Redes, Angel? And you've conducted it in many different forms, including in concert?
Well, first of all, Revueltas is another tragedy in the history of music. And I think a comparison is pertinent to Ives and Gershwin. With Gershwin, unfortunately, Revueltas was also considered an amateur. With Ives, probably the same way that Ives was born too early, Revueltas was born at the wrong time, probably. Of course, I don't know any other composer that was so committed politically. I mean, I cannot imagine, I mean, maybe you have another example, but somebody whose life was completely committed to politics, social justice. He was a member of the Communist Party. He was a representative of the League of the Communist Artists. He went to the Civil War in Spain. I don't think any other composer in the world I can know has been as committed as him with politics. About Reyes, well, as Joe said, this is an extraordinary soundtrack. I mean, the whole thing is this symphonic poem of the music that never interlops with the image. So it's a beautiful symphonic poem in the images. The cinematographer is Paul Strand. And the music is somehow reinforcing those images, but not competing with them. It's really extraordinary.
Angel, what is the meaning of the word redes in the way he uses it here?
Yes, redes is the fisherman's nets.
Ah.
And of course, it's a metaphor of the oppression of the fishermen that are somehow in a net, you know, oppressed by the people that own the boats. The film is absolutely a film emphasizing the poverty and the terrible labor situation of the fishermen.
Think about
a
this.
A product of the Mexican Revolution.
Just think for a moment of the 1930s, wildly politically active. It's the time of the Great Depression across the world, all sorts of communism and stuff. I mean, Trotsky was down in Mexico before he was assassinated. In Mexico, Frida Kahlo and all those characters around that. And there was a real impulse. Lorca is going to come along pretty soon. Did Lorca and Revueltas happen to work together, do you know?
Well, actually, one of the most extraordinary pieces by Revueltas is the homage that he wrote to Lorca when Lorca died. He never met him in person because when he was in Spain, Lorca was already assassinated.
Wow.
Lorca was assassinated in 1936, and Revueltas was in Spain in 1937.
Wow.
But that caused him such a impression, a terrible impression, and such a disappointment, and he wrote this probably one of the most dramatic music that Revueltas wrote.
So we're going to hear the ending of Redes. This is music that really, I would say, requires knowledge of what's on the screen. And what is on the screen is men rowing boats. So you'll hear the music of rowing. And why are they rowing? They're rowing because they're angry and they're revolting against the forces, the capitalist forces, in the city that exploit them, and they've banded together and they're storming the citadel of power.
Wow. Let's listen.
Thank you.
sounds like the good guys won that one. They finally got to a huge triumphant major chord at the end. But I see what you mean, Joe, about the rowing theme that starts out. It sounds like just one man rowing. And then it's two men rowing. And pretty soon it's 100 men rowing and then 1,000 men rowing.
It's a revolutionary surge. The film doesn't tell us whether they win or not.
But that chord...
The music tells us to be optimistic about the great socialist future which awaits us sometime, and we don't know exactly when. Let's begin by saying this doesn't sound like anybody else's music.
Oh, certainly not.
Revueltas has his own sonic signature. But right now, when there's such an emphasis on social justice and the arts serving social justice, I just can't say this strongly enough. This is the composer we should be studying. He is the great political composer of the Western Hemisphere. Whoa. You can put him up against what was going on in the Soviet Union in its first great decade of cultural achievement, or in Weimar Germany. Mm-hmm. There's nothing like that in the United States. You have people like Mark Blitzstein, Aaron Copland, who are attempting a political statement, but it's dwarfed by the political statement that's being made by Diego Rivera or by...
Shostakovich and others.
Well, I was just going to Mexico by Revueltas, where they seem to embody the Mexican experience. You know, they are saying, this is Mexico. You never get this feeling from Copland or Blitzstein. And how does he do it? Partly because of what we've been talking about for the last 90 minutes, recourse to the vernacular. So, Ankel, tell us how the vernacular, how the banda, how the street cries infiltrates the sonic world of Revueltas.
That was his world, and actually he wouldn't accept any other kind of inspiration for his music. So his references are, you know, the street vendors, the mariachis that actually are playing. At the same time, if you go to Mexico City, to Plaza Garibaldi, where the mariachis advertise themselves to play, you are listening to 300 people playing at the same time, which is very Ives, too.
Absolutely.
And this is, I mean, we are talking about two composers that they cannot imagine their inspiration other than what they are seeing, their lives, you know, where they grew up, etc., etc. I mean, in the case of Revueltas, he's so political that actually, in some cases, actually, the piece that you mentioned, Bill, which is beautiful, Caminando, which is inspired in a poem by Nicolás Guillén, the Cuban poet, another totally committed political artist, he even refuses to use instruments that are not played by the village bands. I mean, the instrumentation of that piece, he uses trumpets, he uses clarinets, he uses the double bass, he uses the violins, but he refuses to use, for example, the cello or the oboe or even the flute, which might sound a little bourgeois. So it's very extreme. I mean, I've never seen such an extreme composer like Sylvester Revueltas.
It's interesting to imagine.
Maybe Mahler. Mahler. You know, I think there is a lot of Mahler in Revueltas too.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, because he did smash stuff together. I'm just trying to imagine this little thought experiment. Let's take Revueltas and Charles Ives and send them to St. Mark's Plaza in Venice, because that's similar thing that you occur there. You might hear seven bands playing in front of the great cathedral there, right?
Imagine
what Revueltas or Ives might have done in Venice. That would turn your head around.
So why does Ankel mention Mahler? Because, again, we're dealing with a composer in very close relationship to the vernacular.
You know, earlier in our show, you used the expression, first on the vernacular and then going through a sense of the past. That almost defines what Mahler was doing, doesn't it? Relying on the tropes that he had heard.
I've asked myself a question we should all ask ourselves. How does Revueltas do it? How is it possible that such political art can at the same time be such great and enduring art? And my answer is his reliance on the past. He's anchored. We feel roots. And that's what makes the great Soviet silent films of the 20s, like Mother and Earth, such great films. Because, they're propaganda films. But there's also this notion of Earth, the land, which is so deeply embedded in the consciousness of Russia. Revueltas is able to tap something that's very deeply embedded. So when he makes a political statement, it's huge. Mm-hmm. And it has a resonance far beyond the typical political art that is really a form of journalism sometimes more than it is artistic expression.
Mm-hmm. Joe, now that you talk about Russia, I think something that actually was very interesting in your book is, so Russia actually is able to to find a line. You are, of course, emphasizing how Germany is the best example of a lineage. I mean, there is a very clear line in their history, in their musical history. I would add that, for example, Spain had a big gap, but it found it. It was able to find it, you know, at the end of the 19th century.
We pronounce the word lineage, but you're absolutely right. We're talking about lineage. Here's a country, Russia, which, like the United States, gets a very late start in classical music. Mm-hmm. If you're looking at the 18th century in Russia, the musicians are all foreigners. Mm-hmm. You know, they might be from Spain, or they might be from Italy, they might be from Germany. And that's not until you get to Glinka that you begin to find the beginnings of a national school with roots and lineage. But look at how quickly they found their voice. Within a matter of decades, they're there.
The Russian Five, but also Tchaikovsky and everything that comes beyond that.
Yeah. So why were we so slow and why were they so quick is an interesting question.
And then, you know, in the case of Spain, it's exactly the contrary case of Dvorak. We embraced Scarlatti. This is something that you also mentioned in your book, which I like very much. So we embraced Scarlatti, and we create this extraordinary school of keyboard in the 18th century. And Scarlatti becomes a Spaniard.
Right.
You know, it's like Kurt Weill coming to the United States. Mm-hmm. Immediately, he was born in Naples, which actually at the time was Spain anyway. You know? But that's also very interesting. I mean, the case of Scarlatti is exactly the contrary as Borja. He comes to Spain and everybody loves him. And Boccherini is the same.
That's exactly
and
what
they
I'm
embrace.
Thinking.
Can you imagine Boccherini without Spain? It's impossible to imagine.
Yeah, in this country, to go back to the topic we began with 2 hours ago, we don't really agree that Dvorak became an American composer, the way Scarlatti became a Spanish composer.
Well, but Boccherini and Scarlatti spent the rest of their lives in Spain.
That's true.
Dvorak is here for 5 incredibly fertile years.
It was very quick study. The reason we listen to the American suite, or the reason that we might listen to the F major humoresque or the G flat humoresque, is to prove to ourselves that within 3 years, he was speaking a different language. Hmm. I've said this for years, and nobody believes me, but he becomes an American composer.
He could have become an American if his music would have been embraced, as you know, the people we are mentioning now. He might have stayed in the United States. He loved the time in Iowa.
Well, Mrs. Thurber's husband went bankrupt. That's the reason he went back, because the money dried up. But he loved Iowa. He also loved Bohemia. But it's absolutely true that if there had not been a panic in 1893 and Mr. Thurber had lost his fortune, Dvorak absolutely would have spent more time in the United States. And we can see, although nobody seems to notice it, that in these 3 short years, he's rapidly evolving an idiom completely new to him. You listen to the American suite, does that sound like Dvorak? No way. You listen to the beginning of the F major humoresque, the G flat humoresque. This doesn't sound like Dvorak. He's already an American composer, but this progression is truncated. It's cut off when he rather suddenly goes back to Prague, 1895. And he's a guy who's at the mercy of his surroundings. The music is not in his head. It's all around him. So he drops his American style, and it does not evolve any further than the American suite. But it evolved a lot, and we've never in this country known or acknowledged that.
No more symphonies after he went back to Prague, but he wrote operas, which are very popular still, and he finished the cello concerto.
And tone poems. So this is Mike Beckerman's terrain, and Mike Beckerman will tell you, as a Dvorak scholar, that as a quasi-programmatic symphony, the New World is a kind of linchpin. After that, tone poems and operas.
He wanted to tell stories. Interesting.
He'd been telling stories all along, but they're a secret. What's the story in the slow movement of the G major symphony, which has a funeral march? We can only guess.
Oh, well, I'm thinking of the opening.
What's the story there?
It sounds like the story of a very old people.
He's always got stories in his head, for sure. It's rare that he told us what they were, but at the end of his life, these tone poems, they're equal to Richard Strauss as literal settings of incident and word. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that he was redirected by his experience of Wagnerism in New York.
It's interesting. In your book, you brought out the fact that when Dvorak was here, what, 4 or 5 years in New York?
Three and a half.
He went to the Met Opera precisely once.
One time.
It was to hear Siegfried there. And then he didn't go back again.
His friend,
is funny, because in Prague, he was a member of the opera orchestra. He played for Wagner.
His friend Zeidel, who conducted at the Met, they were the closest friends, was conducting Siegfried. And this story is well known, that Dvorak felt completely out of place among the box holders at the Met. He was very uncomfortable among these rich Americans.
Feeling like a country bumpkin,
kind of? He felt like a country bumpkin, kind of. And he never went back.
Wow.
But Wagner, the experience of Wagner, which of course he could read and score, you can hear it in the New World Symphony.
Oh, yeah.
You can hear it in the tone poems.
Well, he was playing it in Prague.
But it's an influence that's heightened by his experience in New York. Hmm. Wagner was all around him. Mm-hmm. His closest friend was a disciple of Wagner, Zeidel. So the Wagnerian influence. Yet Dvorak is such an absorber of diverse influences that there's times when you can hear just a ton of Brahms or a ton of Schubert or a ton of Wagner. He goes through phases.
But it always sounds like Dvorak to me. It does.
That's true, too.
Yep.
Those variations he composed for orchestra are very, very Brahmsian. Mm. They wouldn't exist without the Brahms Haydn
variations. Sure. We got time for one more piece today? What are we doing?
Well, on our list here of these neglected composers who don't fall within the standard narrative, and these are huge figures. I mean, we're talking about Ives, Gershwin, Dvorak, Revueltas. I insist that Lou Harrison is also a huge figure. Mm-hmm. And if you ask me, what's the most formidable concerto by an American, I would say the Lou Harrison Piano Concerto. And I would also rank very high the work we're about to sample, which is the Harrison Concerto for violin and percussion. He's definitely not a modernist. He definitely doesn't fit the standard narrative. Mm-hmm. So, Ankel, this is a piece you know well. You've conducted several times. You've recorded. What would you like to tell us about the violin concerto by Lou Harrison?
Before arriving to the United States, the name Lou Harrison was, I mean, to me, somehow known. But I get actually to know his music during my time at Wesleyan University when I was working there. As you know, Wesleyan has an extraordinary ethnomusicology department, and I was surrounded by gamelans, by Chinese groups. My neighbor was Anthony Braxton. My other neighbor was Alvin Lucier. So it was an extraordinary place for discovering what makes actually, in my opinion, American music so distinctive. So I was surrounded by true American people. And of course, the gamelan, you know, Lou Harrison in gamelan was the natural thing to do. The violin concerto is an incredible piece. I mean, who could write a concerto for violin and 5 percussionists already? Only Lou Harrison. But now, these 5 percussions are, the percussionists are playing not regular percussion instruments. They're playing junk percussion, flower pots, brakes, you know, car brakes, bathtubs, all the most incredible imaginable things. What can be more American than that? So it's a fascinating piece. And Lou Harrison is, another visionary, another person who lived in his own world, neglected, of course. As we have mentioned in these beautiful conversations, somehow post-classical ensemble is the advocate of lost causes. And Harrison is one of them.
Yeah, we're going straight to another lost cause when we do Dawson this spring. So we're going to listen again to an excerpt from one of the 6 documentary films that I produced as companion films to Dvorak's Prophecy. It's called the Dvorak's Prophecy film series. And 4 of these films are post-classical ensemble films, one of which is about Lou Harrison. And we spend a lot of time with the violin concerto. Here is Bill Richards, our principal percussionist, extracting from the first movement a passage in which Harrison says the percussion should finely shimmer and glitter while the violin chants. And we will first hear just the percussion without the violin to hear how Harrison makes the percussion instruments, which we think of as noisy, glitter, and shimmer.
Here is what it sounds like with the violin added.
So I would call that the development section of the first movement from a recording with Tim Fain and Angel conducting our five post-classical ensemble percussionists. Bill, do you know this piece?
No, I don't.
So can you identify what percussion instruments we were just listening to?
Oh, Batchelor. You hear like all the, it's a bass drum, I think it's going, oh,
No.
This is a washed
You'll never guess what you're hearing.
Okay, tell me what I'm listening to. I don't know.
Well, the pitched instrument is a double bass set on its side, hit with, what is he using, drumsticks on the double bass, Angel?
No, he created a kind of a metallic
mallet,
sticks, like a cymbalon.
Yeah, and that's playing the strings of the double bass, which is lying on a table.
Gotcha.
Angel, do you have anything else you'd like to say about the passage we just heard? There's nothing else like it, right?
This is beautiful. I mean, how can you make poetry from junk? I mean, it's unbelievable.
In his youth, Lou Harrison knew John Cage very well, and they were living on opposite coasts, and they started to play this game. You know the way you can play correspondence chess? You send a move to someone. This is in the mail. I used to play a long time to do this.
Yeah.
They played musical correspondence, and somebody would write a couple measures and send it off, and then the other composer on the other side of the country would write the next two or three measures, and together they composed pieces for a percussion ensemble. This is John Cage and Lou Harrison. I think this sort of music comes out of that experience. Take whatever sounds you can hear and create an archipelago, like a kind of arch that puts it all together.
Absolutely, Bill. And that piece, actually, that you were mentioning is on our CD, too.
Wow.
The double music.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic.
The third movement, the shortest of the movements from this violin concerto, he actually added sometime later than having composed the first two. It's the most virtuosic. And before we listen to our recording with Tim Fain, what would you like to tell us about the finale, Angel, of this remarkable violin concerto by Lou Harrison?
Well, another very important source of inspiration for Harrison is Indian music, which is very present in the piano concerto too. But I think in this, specifically in this movement, this is the main source of inspiration for him. The whole concerto has, of course, a very important Alban Berg inspiration in the, you know, the violin concerto by Berg is especially present in the first movement. But here in the third, I would say that, you know, the idea of the, you know, ragas is crucial.
Yes, it's amazing to ponder the diverse sources of Harrison's inspiration. Dennis Russell Davies, who knew Harrison well, told me that Harrison said his two favorite composers. Does anybody want to guess who Lou Harrison's two favorite Western composers were?
I can't wait to hear.
I bet you can't even get one of them. Angel, you want to guess?
I have no idea.
Brahms and Handel.
I was going to say Handel. I don't know why. Yeah, how about that?
And no, here he is feasting on Alban Berg in the violin concerto. Yeah. So let's listen. Again, I got to ask the same question. How is it possible we don't know this piece? How is it possible it's not performed? What is there not to like in the finale of the Lou Harrison Concerto for Violin and Percussion?
It may sound to you like the soundtrack to a Bollywood film production, but it's not from India. That's a composer from California, Lou Harrison.
Tim Fain, violinist, post-classical ensemble, conducted by Angel Gil Ordonez. So we'll now conclude with yet another of these composers who's been marginalized by the standard narrative, who's not a modernist. I feel the most underrated 20th century American composer is Bernard Herrmann. And this is not an unfamiliar name, but we stigmatize him and mainly know him as a film composer.
Well, he wrote all those films for Hitchcock. Man, they're fantastic.
And he is a great film composer, but he also has a wonderful clarinet quintet. He has a cantata, Moby Dick, I've always wanted to hear live. And of course, this opportunity never presents itself. A big symphony, I've always wanted to hear live. And this opportunity never presents itself. And from his film music, he himself created a psychonarrative. Angel, what would you like to tell us about the psychonarrative that Herrmann created from his film score for the film Psycho?
So here is another advocacy for a lost cause. In the case of Herrmann, he was a most successful composer, but he was the victim of his own success because, unfortunately, the music that he wrote for Helm somehow obscured completely the music that he wrote for the concert. As Joe mentioned, a huge cantata, symphonic poems, a symphony, etc. The psychonarrative is actually a narrative, almost a symphonic poem for the strings. Actually, the first approach to Herrmann was a festival in 2016 that we did in collaboration with the National Gallery, and I conducted there the premiere of his Sinfonietta, the original version of the Sinfonietta, 1930. So we are facing a composer with a huge influence in Béla Bartók and the Second Vienna School, more than Schoenberg, actually, Alban Berg and Anton Weber, I would say. And Psycho is a product of those influences, but with a very, which is the most important thing about Herrmann, there is a sound of Herrmann. We are talking about Dvorak. It sounds like Dvorak. Revueltas sounds like Revueltas. Ives sounds like Ives. Well, Bernard Herrmann sounds like Bernard Herrmann. The Psycho narrative is an incredible case of that.
So let's hear the Psycho narrative. This is a Naxos CD that captures a live performance by Post-Classical Ensemble conducted by Angel Gil Ordóñez. Thank you.
I loved hearing this again just now. I heard this for the first time in my experience when you invited me down to Washington a couple years ago, Joe. This was a concert you gave at the National Cathedral with Angel conducting this music of Bernard Herrmann. And I loved hearing it, but I love it even more hearing it again. It's even better than I remembered. This is music drawn from Bernard Herrmann's score to Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, Believe It or Not.
Well, gentlemen, I would like to thank the three of you, Dave Ozenberg, who's the producer, Angel Gil Ordóñez, my 18-year colleague with Post Classical Ensemble, Bill McLaughlin. Mm. We've been doing these shows
for a while now. Coon's age, I think they say. Yeah.
For all the shows, and especially for today's show, celebrating my new book, Dvorak's Prophecy, published by W.W. Norton. I'm also going to pitch the 6 documentary films, which are released by Naxos. The first is on Dvorak and the American experience of race. The second is Charles Ives' America. We heard an excerpt. The third is on William Dawson. It's called The Souls of Black Folk. The fourth is on Aaron Copland, who we have not mentioned, who is the author of the standard narrative that we are re-examining. The fifth is on Bernard Herrmann. And the last is on Lou Harrison. These products are all over the web. The simplest way to get to them is just via josephhorowitz.com.
Congratulations, Joe, on the new book.
I add my fervent congratulations. It's my favorite book that you've made so far, and I've read all of them, going back to Toscanini.
Wow. Well, I'm very happy to hear that, Bill.
Yeah. Folks, go and find this. Dvorak's Prophecy, Joseph Horowitz, who has read and thought about all this intricacy of the history of American music. It's not just the stuff you know. It's not just Absolutely in Blue and all the rest of it. It's everything. So read the book, Dvorak's Prophecy. And this brings us to the close of this particular episode of Post Classical. I'm sitting here with Joseph Horowitz, our friend and maestro. Angel Gil Ordóñez has been sitting in, listening to us and speaking with us from Washington, D.C. Our producer, David Ozenberg. Thanks for all of you for joining us today. I'm Bill McLaughlin. Join us next time. You never know what you're going to get with Joe Horowitz, and this is a good example.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Bill.
We hope you've enjoyed tonight's special 3-hour presentation of Post Classical with your hosts, Bill McLaughlin, Joseph Horowitz, and Angel Gil Ordóñez. We want to thank our recording engineer for this episode, especially since this episode had to deal with, again, Zoom calls and multi-destination recording, and that is Bill Zygmunt from Desert Island Studios. I am David Ozenberg, the producer of Post Classical. Once again, Joseph Horowitz's new book, Dvorak's Prophecy and the Vexed Fate of Black Classical Music, is published by Norton Press, and you can find it anywhere good books are available. Post Classical is an exclusive production of the award-winning WWFM, the Classical Network, and WWFM.org. Have a great evening.